Blog Talk Radio.
Gonna tell you a little bedtime tale, legend it will become. Burgers flying out the door, sail on. 2-for-1, no concern for the future, living for today. Fast food bite on your way, lay it all to waste. The masses are afflicted now. Moo, mad cow, mad cow, mad cow, mad cow, line dance song.
Hey, Sign Guy Nation, welcome to the show here on another Friday afternoon. Sign Guy and QT back with you like normal. I would like to start the show off by introducing someone returning to our show. It's been about a year since he's been with us, and he's been very busy in the time since he was last with us. I would like to introduce the legendary Tennessee stud, Ron Fuller. Sir, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be back, and nice to be on your program again, and looking forward to having a good time this afternoon.
Absolutely. Now, I referenced that you've been busy since you last were on our show. Shortly after that, you launched the Tennessee Studcast, which you have with Tony Basilio, and it's chronicled your family's history in the professional wrestling in chronological order. It's a very unique podcast. Not very many people do chronological historical shows like you do, particularly in the wrestling business. What led to you deciding that was what you wanted to do and getting things rolling for the Tennessee Studcast?
Well, I guess it all started with the fact that I come from the largest wrestling family on the planet, largest in size and oldest as well. My grandfather started wrestling in 1924. His name was Roy Welch. And there's a lot of people that don't know much about my family history. I come, obviously, a four-generation wrestling family, 93 years, just turned over to 94 years in 2018, 94 years, and we're still going strong. We got a member still wrestling, two of them, actually, of the family that are still wrestling. So I just wanted to tell my family story because it was so – it had been kept so kayfabe for many years. My grandfather never talked much about it, didn't want to be in the spotlight, just wanted to be in the background. My dad was kind of the same way. I was the same way during my generation, and I just felt like it was time to maybe let people know what we were all about and how many people was involved in our family and the background of what we did. A lot of us were not just wrestlers, but wrestlers and promoters, and we have had a great mark on the wrestling business. A lot of things have come from my family, the Welch family. First Wrestling Bear, tag team wrestling. A whole lot of things go way back to my grandfather and what he started. And so that's just what I wanted to do. I thought about doing it and telling the story, and it just makes sense. If you're going to tell a 90-year story, you kind of tell it in chronological order. And I started back with my granddad in 1902 at his birth, and I'm just now, after 6 months, about to get the tights on myself. So I've gone through two generations in the last 6 months of Studcast, and I'm really humbled by the response. Thousands and thousands of listeners now. I mean, it's really staggering, the number. I can't believe how many people have gotten into it, and I'm just real thankful that the good Lord's given me a great story, and I'm a pretty decent storyteller.
You're a magnificent storyteller, in my opinion. And the Studcast has really taken off. It also enabled you to launch the website, TennesseeStud.com, and the Stud Store, where people can buy merchandise. My wife, of course, a proud owner of a Tennessee Stud t-shirt that she has tweeted out there. when you launched the store, were you prepared for the response you were going to get from people wanting to get pictures and T-shirts? And I believe the CDs are just about available.
Yeah, we're in the process of trying to get those first CDs out. Like I said, the whole experience for me has been pretty humbling. I didn't expect to get anywhere near the response that I have. And it's not just American listeners, which is really phenomenal. I mean, I've got listeners that come literally from all over the world. And lots of people, wrestling is very hot in England, a lot of people in England. I got a lot of Australia fans. I've got India from the country of India. It's just from everywhere, really. Africa, I see people's, it's like, wow, I can't believe they listen to the program. So it's been really humbling for me, but I really enjoy it. I had no idea when I started doing podcasting that I had any great penchant or, I had the skills or whatever, but I've really found I enjoy it. I really like just, sitting down in front of that microphone and turning loose each week and being able to tell my family's history is quite a thrill for me, and it's an honor, and it's going to leave, in the end, a legacy for my family that people know about us for the first time in 90-something years. Unless you're a Southerner and been in the southern part of the United States where we spend most of our lives and most of our careers, you're probably not very familiar with us. In the South, that's a name you know very well, the Welches and the Fullers and the Goldens and the Fields, and all those names come from my granddad and his father. And so it's just amazing and something I just really am proud of at this point. You know, that I think that the program is proven to be a success. I feel comfortable that we've got a lot of listeners, and I get fabulous comments that people really seem to really enjoy what I do, and I'm doing something that a lot of podcasts don't do. I'm talking wrestling history, and there's not a lot of them that do that because they don't have that history. And I'm one of the few people alive that has been in it as long as my family has, and to have watched his grandfather wrestle and watched my father wrestle, and I've watched my son wrestle. So, I've been there and seen it just about all.
You talked about how big your family was and how many members there were, and you are an absolute legendary family. But coming from the Southeastern, there's a lot of legendary families out there, not nearly as big as yours, but several families that have multiple generations. Anyone that listens to this show or knows me knows that one of my favorite wrestling families would be the Gilbert family out of Lexington, Tennessee. Did you have much interactions with one of the other legendary families in wrestling, the Gilberts?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I wrestled with Tommy Gilbert in 1975. I wrestled against Tommy. I've wrestled partners with Tommy. Great guy. I really have a lot of respect for Tommy and his son, Eddie. Eddie was a tremendous, tremendous wrestler, better than his dad, I think, actually. And I didn't have a lot of interaction with Eddie because I seemed to be in a different part of the country. But I just heard great, great comments from I know thousands of wrestlers, and they all really admired Eddie. They liked being around him. And so I'm familiar with Tommy and Eddie, and I'm familiar with that Gilbert family. And, I got another one for you, another family that's really phenomenal and that I've spent a tremendous amount of time with and probably had some of my greatest matches with are the Armstrongs, which, those four sons of Bob Armstrong were just really great talents in the ring. And Bob Armstrong himself, WWE Hall of Fame. So, there are a lot, and as you've said, there's a lot of families in the South that have that second generation, and some of them even have the third, but I happen to be the only family that has four generations. that have actually wrestled in the ring and promoted and done it all, a little bit of everything.
Someone else that we're very familiar with from our show here, as well as working with them in the Pacific Northwest where we're based, is someone that you know very well. He's been on the Studcast a couple of times, that being Kevin Sullivan. What were your memories of a very young Kevin Sullivan who was very different when he broke in compared to the middle and later part of his career?
Yeah, that's a real good point. I mean, there's two different individuals there entirely. Kevin, when he first started, was a nice, wonderful guy. I mean, he was gung-ho, just driven to be a star. Really worked his rear end off in the ring every time he wrestled. And as his career progressed and he got into the, I'm going to call it the crazy days, where he just kind of went overboard and off. I know Kevin well enough. I think all of this pretty much started in Australia with Mark Lewin and King Curtis Aika and that group. It was probably early mid-70s, that Kevin came back from an Australia trip as a different guy. And he kind of turned a little dark, man. His character went from one side, a sweet young boy from Boston, to a freak from I don't know where, you know. But Kevin's an interesting person. In fact, I spoke to Kevin today. I'm still friends with Kevin, and I had a conversation with him today. And he does live right out there close to where you guys are, right? He lives in some island there. I've not been to his home, but knowing Kevin, it's probably a little bit, it's a beautiful place and probably a little bit creepy too.
That's a fair assessment, yes. Now, Kevin Sullivan is someone, for the fans that may not know the history of it, he was able to transform not only his character, but his body. At one point, he was in competitive weightlifting and bodybuilding, and he looked like a bodybuilder right out of the Mr. Olympia Games, and he transformed his body and looked more like a powerlifter later on in his career, which he was into heavy powerlifting at that point. Have you seen many people that completely transform their bodies the way that Kevin did, going from one form of physique to a completely different one and then possibly back again?
Well, I don't know about the back again, but I do have a great example. And when I started wrestling in Florida as a young guy in 1970, my first year in wrestling, there was another guy started down there. Obviously, there was a lot of young guys down there. You had Mike Graham, who was Eddie Graham's son. You had some wrestler sons that were getting started at that point. Lester Welch in my own family, and he had a son named Roy Lee and a son named Jackie. There was a friend of Mike Graham's who started wrestling. His name was Dennis McCord. Dennis McCord was a power lifter, a big guy. He must have weighed, I don't know his exact weight at that time, but he was well over 300 pounds and probably only about 6'2". He was just huge. And he wrestled a lot with me in Florida there in the early years. And then in 1973, we both did a tour together in Australia. And Dennis was still the same size. He still had that huge bulk to him. He had black hair, and he had black hair all over his body. He had quite a bit of body hair. So after we left Australia, I didn't see Dennis for probably a year. Might have been even more than that. Might have been 2 years. And I went to wrestle in Memphis in 1974 or maybe early 75. And I sat down next to a guy that had bleach blonde hair, and I'd never seen him before. And normally I go and introduce myself when I go into a dressing room. That's just kind of a way business is handled, and you introduce yourself. So I just sat down, and I started putting on my boots. He was putting on his boots. And after about 10 minutes of quiet, he nudged me with his elbow, and he says, are you not going to say hello? And I could tell by the voice, I was like, dang, that voice is familiar. And I looked at him, and I was like, I had to look three times. It was like, this, who is this guy? And then he stood up, and when he stood up, he had probably lost 60 pounds. He had thinned his body and toned his body until, I said, Dennis? And he goes, Austin. I said, what do you mean, Austin? And he says, Austin Idol. I'm like, are you kidding me, man? I was like, what did you do to yourself? I mean, it just freaked me out. I'd never seen a transformation in the body that much. Now, Austin never went back to that Dennis McCord size. Probably wouldn't have been good for his health if he had. But that is a great example of someone that transformed their body unbelievably. If you ever find a picture of Dennis McCord in the early years of 1970s, early 70s, out of Florida, and you send that picture and put it beside Austin Idol's picture, and you'll be just as surprised as I was that a person could do that to their body.
Absolutely. He is a perfect example of that. One of the things that has been a little controversial in professional wrestling, as well as other major contact sports in the last decade or so, is concussions. I know that when you were actively wrestling, not as much was known about the effects of them long term or the treatment of them. Now that you have the information that is out there about concussions and see what some of the effects can be, do you think that a lot of the wrestlers that were active when you were wrestling and promoting may have taken more risk than they should have as far as the concussions go in regards to their long-term careers and their long-term health?
Absolutely. I think undoubtedly that's the case. Now, if you look further back than my generation, if you go back to my granddad's generation, he started in 1924, and those guys would bust each other hard ways, and you can't hit a person hard enough in his eye or in his forehead to break his skin open without giving him a concussion. You basically got to almost knock him out. And so, you know, I have no idea of how many times my grandfather had that happen to him. But I can tell you, probably a significant number of times, and he died of Alzheimer's. He had a dementia problem. My father was just like my grandfather, just believed in the wrestling, the sport being as legitimate as it could possibly be, and encouraged guys to do hard ways. My dad did, I don't know how many my dad did. If you've seen some of the pictures on my website and listen to some of my studcasts, you'll hear me talk about some of those hard ways. And there was one picture, one match in Atlanta, Georgia with Mario Galento, in which my dad hard weighed both eyes and just a bloody mess. And he ended up dying the same way as my grandfather, with Alzheimer's dementia problem. And there's a, you know, I have to be honest, there's probably a pretty good likelihood that I'm going to end up the same way, because I have had my eyes busted a couple of times. And when you're a wrestler, you're going to get knocked out occasionally, and it's going to happen in a way that you don't have to be hit in the head by somebody. You're going to hit your own head on something, on the ring apron or on the ring post or whatever it may be, a turnbuckle with the padding not on there as it should be. And you're going to be dazed to unconscious on many occasions. And now that we're finding out that every one of those blows to the head is going to affect you in later life in an adverse way. And You know, I'm not looking forward to that possibility, and that's kind of one of the reasons I want to keep doing the Studcast, because it forces me to use my mind. And that by continually searching and driving my mind to come back with old memories and to think of old things, it's making me, I believe, fight any of those things off longer than they were able to. They experienced the dementia problem in their 60s. And I'm just about 70, so, you know, I'm not, and I haven't shown any signs of it, thank goodness, thank the good Lord. But, yeah, I think that, yes, there's a definite potential and a probability that a heck of a lot of wrestlers, and it's not just my dad and my grandfather, it's a lot of wrestlers when you really start finding out about how guys die. And a lot of that is from a dementia problem, or a problem probably from a lot of concussions.
One of the things that we have noticed on our show, talking to various wrestlers at all of the levels in wrestling, from the independents to the major promotions, most people seem to have a favorite venue where they've performed, be it a major a stadium or just one of the local venues that held a special place in their heart for whatever reason. Did you have a favorite venue for wrestling when you were actively in the ring?
I wrestled in 1973. Vince Sr. invited me to come and wrestle in Madison Square Garden in New York. I mean, I think any kid in America or anybody that has any athletic background, I've played basketball at the University of Miami, and, you know, I have a knowledge of buildings in America, and that one is a great one. I mean, that's to be able to wrestle in Madison Square Garden is a real honor and a real pleasure, and actually I went there twice and wrestled for him. The Cal Palace, San Francisco. Just the name and just the reputation, it's not, you know, and I wrestled there in 85. It's an old building, you know, but the Cow Palace, just because you've wrestled in the Cow Palace. I love the Sumo Hall in Tokyo. I wrestled in the Sumo Hall in Tokyo with 24,000 people, no chairs. They sit on their butts with their legs crossed. Pretty a phenomenal sight to see that many people sitting side by side on the rear ends. So there, and you know, I've wrestled outside the Vince in big stadiums and Texas Stadium and lots of different places that I, you know, I really enjoyed. I really enjoyed just being part of the pleasure and the thrill of it is not always who you wrestle, but sometimes it is where you're wrestling and the building, the facility you're in. That's a really good question, yeah. Madison Square Garden, for sure, probably my all-time favorite, simply because, in my opinion, it's one of the most famous buildings in America.
In a similar vein to that, strictly as a promoter of wrestling, did you have a favorite venue that you got to promote shows?
I did not promote in the Omni. I like the Omni in Atlanta. It's a beautiful building, a round building. There's so many buildings that you bring that up that come to mind that I didn't mention. Mid-South Coliseum in Memphis is a tremendous building. A round facility holds 12, maybe 14,000. The Omni's maybe 18,000. I had there was a Coliseum in Knoxville that I really liked. No one had ever run wrestling in that building because it was so big, and that wrestling wasn't popular when I went to Knoxville and started Southeastern Wrestling. And I was able to build that company big enough that we started going to the Coliseum. And we sold out. The biggest crowd they ever had in that building for any event was me wrestling Harley for the world title in 1977. And that was a thrill for me because the building's a big building and it had never had that many people in it. They somehow, the fire marshal must not have been there that night, and they allowed people to sit in the aisles, and they probably had 40% over capacity, maybe 50% over capacity of what the building should hold. And then there was someone told me they probably had more people outside than inside that couldn't get in. So it's a real thrill when you own your own company and you sell out your biggest buildings, and you know, that's a big thrill in itself. And so I'd say, you know, that Coliseum in Knoxville, because it was my first territory, it's the first company, wrestling company I ever built, and it turned out to be so successful, hugely successful, and that we used to go in there and that fill that thing up every week, every Friday night. But that house, that particular crowd, is really the one I remember the most because it was just so much bigger than what the biggest crowd we'd ever had in there was.
Well, at this point in time, my co-host QT Vokes is standing by, and I know QT has questions as well for you, so I'm going to pass things to him for a bit.
All right.
Well, thank you, Sun Guy. Hello, Mr. Fuller.
Hello. How are you?
Oh, very good. Very good. Mr. Fuller, you went up against Hulk Hogan in 1979 in Pensacola, Florida, when he was just starting out. You were 2 years into the business. Well, now I now know that you were more than 2 years into the business. So you were the veteran in this match, and you won against Hulk Hogan. However, I was more intrigued that you had wrestled Harley Race, like you had just mentioned. Looking back on it, I have a gut feeling, like the rock group Devo sang about, that your match, they had a song called Gut Feeling.
Right.
Your match with Harley Race was more important to you and more of a highlight of your career. Am I right in that assumption?
Yeah, probably so. And there's a reason for that. I mean, Hogan at that point was very young. He had probably not had more than, I'd say, maybe only 30 matches. He was trained in Tampa, and you know, I don't know if y'all know all the history of Hogan, but they didn't want to train him, and they tried to discourage him. In fact, the first time he went and worked out in what we used to be called the Snake Pit, the building in which they filmed their television program, and Gordon Solie was the commentator, was their wrestling office. And they had a ring that stayed in there all the time, and they would bring guys in that wanted to learn to wrestle, and they would try them out. And if they liked them, they'd train them, and if they didn't, they'd hurt him. And they broke his leg. They didn't want to train Terry. Terry Bollea is his real name. So they didn't want to train Terry. Then he came back after his leg got well. He came back and they hurt him again. And then they called me from Tampa because I had two wrestling territories at that time. I had the one in Knoxville that I was speaking about earlier, that was located in Knoxville, and another one located in Pensacola, Florida. Two total different companies, and they called me out of Tampa and said, we've got this big huge guy, he's your height, he's bigger than you are, and we really don't want to train him, we don't want him, you know. And so they said, but you know, he might turn out to be good. So I said, well, send him to my booker. And my booker at that time was Louis Tillett in Pensacola. So they sent Terry Bollea there. And I went in and wrestled him on several occasions. I wrestled him at least three times. And I flew in from Knoxville the first night he came because Louis had already met him and worked out with him and had another couple of guys work out with him. And he called me and he said, Ron, this guy's going to be big. I mean, he's got something about him. And so I flew from Knoxville down to Dothan, Alabama. It was a Friday night town there. And wrestled Hogan. It was pretty unusual event. I mean, when I saw him coming to the ring, I was really impressed with his size, as most people were. But you know, he was very green, so obviously, you know, I led match and I was healing, so it was no problem in doing that. And so in Pensacola, we worked, and then we worked the last show he worked for. Georgia Wrestling, WCW, not before WCW, there was Georgia Wrestling. He went and left me and went to Georgia to wrestle, and they they were running Knoxville at that time, and I wrestled him there, and he told me in the dressing room, he says, Ron, I'm going to Vince. I'm going to work in New York. I said, man, that's perfect for you, Terry. I said, they love the big guys. You're going to be a big star there for them, man. I said, I wished him the best of luck. Had a good relationship with him because he was young, and he had great matches with me. And every time we worked afterward, he would say, Ron, gosh, that was one. God, it was fabulous, man. Nobody can do that kind of stuff with me. I was able to do things with him that smaller guys couldn't do. And, yeah, I really had I had a lot of admiration for Terry. And Terry went on to be a huge star. But I guess the reason I really mentioned Harley is because, first of all, it was that particular crowd. And Harley was an unusual heavyweight champion. And I was lucky enough to have worked with at least 10 world champions. And so I've got a real grasp of who's good and who's not and which guys were the best workers and which weren't. And Terry never became a great wrestler because he never had the great training. He didn't get that training that he should have had. He was so big that he could make a name for himself without being talented, without being super talented on the wrestling side of it. And so he never got that ability to be really good in the ring. All the other world champions that I worked with, they were. I mean, they obviously, you didn't get the NWA World Championship belt if you didn't have some real ability, and all of them did. And most of the guys that I wrestled were NWA World Champions.
Well, Mr. Fuller, I believe that the person or the enforcer that they had break Hulk Hogan's leg was a Japanese wrestler of very well esteem. He was known in the – he, I believe, had started wrestling in the 40s. I want to say the name Saito comes to mind, but he was known as Saito. Yeah, I think I'm wrong, but somehow that name rings a bell that he was the one that broke Hulk Hogan's leg.
It could have been. Saito wrestled for me in 1983. Saito came from Japan. Really salty Japanese guy, very, very good, and a lot of shooting background. And he worked for me in Southeastern in Pensacola and was just loved living there, just loved being around the group of guys. Couldn't speak very much English. I think he went from there down to Tampa, and potentially he could have been it. But there's another Japanese that was there that could have been the one that did it if it wasn't Saito. And he was, in my opinion, one of the greatest Japanese of all time, world junior heavyweight champion, Hiro Matsuda. Now, Matsuda and I used to shoot. We used to go in there. We called it the snake pit, that old ring, that old building. We'd go in there in the day, and it was Bob Roop and Hiro Matsuda and me and Jack Briscoe, guys that really wanted to learn how to shoot and how to get tougher, not like a regular match. I mean, we were really trying to learn how to hurt each other and how to hurt people. And Matsuda was there for 2 years of that snake pit stuff. And if Saito didn't get him, it might have been Hiro Matsuda that got him. But I know that they didn't want to train him because I got that from somebody that was down there at the time, said they just wanted to hurt him. They wanted him not to come back. And and back in the old days, that's the way it was. When my grandfather was trained, he was trained by Cal Farley and out of Amarillo, Texas, and the original Dutch Mantell, not the Dutch Mantell that's still out there today, the original Dutch Mantell, a great old shooter, and he broke my granddad's ribs and broke his wrist in two different times trying to get rid of him, thinking that he wouldn't come back. And that's what they did back in the old days, is they didn't want to train you. If they liked you and they respected you and saw you had some skill and some ability, then they would not hurt you. But if they didn't see that skill and ability, they would break ribs or they would break arms or they would break legs. They would do whatever they had to do for you to go, I don't want any part of that. And So that's the way Hulk Hogan, you know, Hulk had a huge upbringing in my southeastern territory there in Pensacola, because he not only worked with me some there, that's how he met Andre. And he and Andre, long before they had that big, huge crowd that WrestleMania III wrestled in Dothan, Alabama against each other with a huge crowd for a small city and in a football stadium. So, you know, Hogan met Andre through there. That's how Hogan ended up going to Vince in New York to begin with, is because Andre liked him, and he was big. Andre could work with him. And Andre told me, he says, "Ron, I like him." I said, "Well, how much do you like him?" "I want to take him to New York." So I said, "Sure, man. I'd love to see him be a huge success. He'll make a lot of money there." So, you know, Hogan has a lot of background that comes from that first early year or so that he was with me in Southeastern Wrestling in Pensacola that led him to New York and led on to him working with Andre in Detroit. And, you know, there's a lot of history there.
You know, I think it may have been Hiro Matsuda that broke – well, Mr. Matsuda – get a tryout for Japan's Olympic wrestling team. I think he may have made it one year and been a Japanese Olympian.
I don't doubt that at all. There was actually another wrestler there. There was another Japanese wrestler there who was an older guy who was probably a great shooter. Now, Saito was a great shooter. Hiro was a great shooter. Matsuda worked with and shot with in the snake pit many, many times. But there was another guy there that was older than all of them, and he probably would have had the skills. He could have done it himself, and that was Duke Kiyomuka. So, you know, there was a lot of Japanese in that Florida territory in the early 70s, and they would run those guys. They would bring those guys out of Japan that they really wanted to train their wrestlers. They wanted them to have that shooting background, and they would send them to, like, my territory where we had some shooters. They would send them then to Tampa. They would then Saito, when he came to me. He left me. He went to Tampa. He left Tampa. He went back home to Japan. He trained some of the greatest wrestling talent in the history of the sport in Japan when he went home. I really love Saito. He had a great feel for the sport, and he was so easy to work with. He just enjoyed himself. He's one of those guys that couldn't talk to you, didn't speak enough English to talk, but had a wonderful time all day and all night, every night, and the wrestlers loved him too. So, you know, could have been one of three Japanese that broke Hogan's leg, and I'm not sure which one it was, but that'd be an interesting thing to find out for sure.
Well, I will do a homework assignment and try to either get a hold of Stein Guy or you and tell you the answer. Yes.
All right, great. Yeah, I love the history of the sport. I tell you, I'm a big, huge historian of the sport, and I can't get enough of it. So, yeah, I'd love to know who actually broke his leg.
Oh, yeah. I will take this homework assignment very seriously. Yes. Okay.
All right.
Well, Ron, what was your highest point total you ever scored in a basketball game while playing for the University of Miami? Can you recall your highest point total?
I was not a great scorer. My highest total in my college career was my freshman year, and I played my freshman year at Clemson. And then after Clemson, I transferred to the University of Miami. I had a 31 rebound game in college at Clemson, which was that was probably the best game I ever had in my life, actually. 31 points and 31 rebounds. That's a load. That's a ton of stuff there. That's a good night. And there was a triple overtime deal. I guess that's where I compiled some points by having a triple overtime. But at the University of Miami, I think probably 20. Maybe around 20 points might have been my best points. I was a lot better rebounder than a scorer, because of my size, and I came from a wrestling background, so I didn't mind getting under the boards there and just throwing my weight around a little bit. I usually fouled out of a lot of games at the University of Miami because I played very physical, and the referees didn't really like my style much. So I had some short games.
Oh, okay. Wow. All right. Well, Mr. Fuller, Archie Henderson was your coach for the Nashville Knights, and in 1982, he was voted the most popular member of the Nashville South Stars hockey team. He was also an enforcer on the South Stars and usually gave their fans their fight fix. My question is, was Mr. Henderson in the running for your choice as a co-host on your podcast show, Studcast? And if so, why did he not get the nod over Tony Basile?
Well, I tell you, it's really funny. That's a heck of a name to come out of. That comes out of nowhere. Archie Henderson, when I bought my first hockey team, I bought a franchise for Nashville. There were four teams in the East Coast Hockey League. Now it's the biggest minor league in the world. I mean, I don't know how many teams they have in there now, but it's monstrous league now. And they were very concerned when I got my franchise for Nashville. They were concerned that I was going to hire a goon coach, because I was a wrestler. They said, you know, we don't want to have, you know, we don't want fights now. We don't want you going out there and hiring a goon coach. And I didn't know anything about hockey. I'd only seen one hockey game in my life, and I bought a franchise for a hockey team and built the team and built an organization and the whole company out of there that turned out to be tremendously successful, far beyond anybody's imagination that hockey would do that far in the South at that time. And I ended up hiring Archie Henderson because I had an interview with a lot of coaches, and he was one of the guys I interviewed, and I liked him. He was about 6'6". He had a rugged-looking face, which I didn't put two and two together, that he'd probably been punched in the nose a whole bunch, you know, and I kind of liked him, and I hired him before I discussed it with the people that owned the league, the people that ran the league. And they asked me, they said, have you picked a coach? One of them I will never forget. And he handled all the business for the league. And he says, have you found a coach, Ron? I said, yes, I have. And he said, who is it? And I said, Archie Henderson. And he went, oh, Ron, no, no. He says, no, you didn't hire him. I said, yeah, I hired him. And he goes, oh, my gosh, we're just going to have trouble the whole year. So Archie, I got along great with Archie. He liked me. He loved the wrestling stories. And we'd travel quite sometimes. I'd take him to games, and rather than him ride the bus with the rest of the players, and he would just want to know all about wrestling. And he knew wrestlers. He was like, how about the Vern? And how about the you know, Roddy Piper? And just different names off the wall people. And I knew all of them. So, you know, we had great conversations. But Archie, I'd never get a shot. He really never got a shot at hosting the Studcast with me. I'm not so sure Archie would have been the right guy to be behind the microphone with me. But Tony Basilio does a great job. I really love working with Tony Basilio on my Studcast. And he's so low-keyed and laid back. And he just allows me to just roll. I just start, and sometimes I stop on purpose so that he can say something. And then he complains. He says, Ron, they want to hear you. They want to hear you. They don't want to hear me. So, you know, we do that Studcast with me doing most of the talking. But Tony does a great job for me. Archie Henderson is the guy on my Studcast. I'm not so sure about that because heck, me and Archie might have got into it before it was all over.
Oh, wow, okay. Boy, okay, that puts a little bit of, how would you say, shine or fact into his character. Yes. Okay.
Yes.
Well, Mr. Fuller, your last interview with Turnbuckle Turmoil, on your last interview with us, I remember that I asked you if you were going to produce your own line of barbecue sauce. I also remember that I read to you the ingredients of a barbecue sauce that I had in my house, and which I believe was Casey Masterpiece. A quick look at some of the ingredients include high fructose corn syrup, tomato paste, distilled vinegar, pineapple juice concentrate, and sodium bentonite as a preservative. My question is, are there any truths to the hockey folklore history in Nashville that before a Nashville South Stars hockey game in 1982, someone on that team convinced Archie Henderson to sneak a frozen bottle of barbecue sauce in his hockey uniform, and when he got into a fight on this particular home match, that he was going to hit the opposite team's goalie with this frozen bottle of barbecue sauce? Any
Oh, I don't know, but I can see it. I can imagine that he would have. I can see that he probably would have done that. You know, so that could have been the case. Now, I didn't actually start my hockey career or get involved in hockey until 1989. So I happened to be the same city in Nashville. Those guys that were there before me, they did not do well. I mean, they didn't draw well. I don't know how that, what kind of teams they had. I was never lucky enough in my hockey career, 5 years in the hockey business and the two teams, to ever have a great team. But I certainly led the league in attendance. I knew how to promote. And so I was really good at that. That would have been something I thought you were going to say. He probably would be smacked one of the players with it, you know, and pull it out and smack one of the players with it. But, you know, that's crazy. Now, when you're talking about barbecue sauce, you ought to be asking Jim Ross about this, you know, isn't that his business? He's really into that, isn't he?
Oh, yes. I think he has an Oklahoma Sooner sauce, I think. Yes.
There you go. Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's the big barbecue guy, man. He's the one for the sauce. You know, he'd probably be able to tell you all his ingredients. I'm sure he wouldn't give you the formula, but you know, he'd be the guy that could answer that stuff. But Archie Henderson, I can believe Archie would do just about anything. You know, he had that attitude. I want to give you one quick story about Archie, if I can do this, okay? I kind of laid the foundation and said, you know, these guys were just horrified when they found out I had Archie as the coach. And they said, Jace, Ron, we're just going to have horrible problems with him. It's going to be a fighting team. Does he have a whole lot of enforcers? They had 100 questions about what's going to happen. And I said, guys, I'm going to stay on top of this guy. I'm going to talk to him. I'm going to tell him what you guys want. You really want to have good hockey, and you want to have that kind of stuff. So the very first game of the season, my team, Nashville, plays Knoxville. It's an in-state rivalry. We're only 180 miles apart. We take my team over there to Knoxville. That night, we have the biggest hockey fight I have ever seen in my life. I was in the stands, and it started with two guys, and then it went to two more, and then two more, and then two more. There's no referees to stop it. So it was all over the ice. Just about everybody on the ice was fighting. And at the end of it, they finally got some type of order there, and they separated the teams, and the two goalies skated to center ice and dropped their gloves, and they fought. I've never seen that before, and I've never saw it since, ever saw that happen. Now, this is the first game. So, and then I look, and now that goalies are fighting, they're out there now trying to get the goalies to quit fighting, and I look on the far side of the ice, and the two benches are side by side with a piece of glass between them, and Archie's crawled up on the wall and reached over and grabbed their coach, who was a small guy, and drug him over the glass and started beating him up in our box, our player box. I was like, oh, my God. Gosh almighty, they're going to throw me out of the league after the first game, you know. It was a horrible start to it. They were afraid of it happening. I was assuring them it wouldn't, and then darn if it didn't happen, 10 times worse than anything I'd ever seen before. So that was Archie. I mean, you know, it was all going, so the crowd obviously was going absolutely crazy. And Archie just had to do something more. Let me grab their coach and drag him over and beat the hell out of him. I was like, Archie, God almighty, you should have stopped, man, at some point. But it was crazy hockey in those days.
Wow, you're lucky it didn't progress down the street and spill over into a bowling alley. You were lucky.
Yeah, I was lucky on several occasions.
Wow. Oh, okay. All right. Well, Mr. Fuller, as we opened up the show today, you heard one of our opening songs, and it's called Mad Cow Line Dance. This is a song with many twists and turns, but is mainly a song about mad cow disease and things not being quite right on a farmer's farm. It has eerie undertones, much like Pink Floyd's The Wall. My question is, do you have an opening song for your show, Studcast?
Yeah, I do, and I actually, be quite honest with you, I don't know the name of the song, but I have a guy that does my openings and my closings, a great talent. He's a DJ in Dothan, Alabama, has a fabulous voice, and he did that opening for me. He does all of my openings and closings for me, and that song he picked out, and I've had so many compliments on that song. So if you listen to the Studcast, it's that opening song. It'll play it again during the break. We take a break and give him a minute to talk about whatever's coming up or whatever's going on, and he plays it again in the close. Now, if you can figure out the name of that, you can tell me. I don't really know the name of it myself. I haven't ever asked him, but I really like the song, and so do a lot of people that listen to my Studcast. They ask me about that song. I just haven't gone to the trouble of finding out what the name of it is.
Oh, okay. I think I had my second homework assignment. Yes.
Yeah, maybe you can track that down. I'd like to know that one, too. If you can tell me who broke Hulk Hogan's leg and who sings that song and where that song comes from, that'd be interesting for me.
All right. Okay, I'll get on that. Okay. Well, Mr. Fuller, you mentioned the Cow Palace to Sun Guy earlier in the show. Do you know that Paul Cook, Steve Jones, Glenn Matlock, and John Lydon, who is known as Johnny Rotten, played their last concert in the Cow Palace in 1978 there. They then disbanded until they got together in the 90s. They had hits like Anarchy in the UK, God Save the Queen, and Pretty Vacant. Do you know what group I'm talking about? This is a musical quiz.
Jeez, man. Now you talk. They're an English group.
Yes.
Are they? They're an English group. Jeez, I don't know.
Yes.
Now you mentioned Devo. I know you're an English music fan, because I noticed you mentioned Devo earlier. I don't know any of the members of Devo, and I don't know that many band members. So you stumped me here.
Okay, they were the Sex Pistols.
Oh heck yes, I know them. I've listened to their music.
Yes. Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah, okay.
Since you mentioned the Cow Palace, I wrestled in the Cow Palace, and you might find this interesting who I wrestled. I wrestled in the Cow Palace. I wrestled Jimmy Superfly Snuka, who was a big talent back in those days, and this was 85. I think it was 85 I wrestled the Snuka in the Cow Palace, and, you know, that's a... and I never met him before, and I never saw him after that. Just I don't know where he came out of, Hawaii maybe, to come to San Francisco for that match, and I actually flew from Pensacola, Florida there. So they flew in two guys from a long way away for a main eventer.
Oh, well, Jimmy Superfly Snuka wrestled back in the 70s for Don Owen in Portland Wrestling. Donna won.
Yep. There you go. Now, this was 85, so I don't know if he was still there for Don, but he was a great talent. He was a great wrestler. I remember having a super match with him, and I'd never met him before. So, you know, since you brought up that Cow Palace again, thought I'd throw that in there.
Oh, very good. Very good. The Superfly had a very good match in Madison Square Garden, where he took off from the top of a steel cage. Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's a flyer.
Oh, who did he land on? I think Don Morocco, I believe. He splashed Don Morocco, I think. Yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Know Don Morocco very well, too. You know, but Superfly loved to fly. You know, he was a flyer. So I can believe that that's the way he would finish it. That makes sense to me.
Oh, one last question before I turn it back over to Sign Guy, and that is, if you could travel back in time and had the choice of one of these three players to play against, who would you choose, Jerry West, Dr. J, or Oscar Robinson?
Jeez, that's a pretty good three right there, I'll tell you. Well, I'm gonna pick Oscar Robinson, and there's a reason for it. I think you'll find this interesting too. I had a high school coach when I was a junior in high school in Griffin, Georgia, that actually played right across. He was a guard on the same team, the Cincinnati Royals, the professional team, with Oscar Robinson. His name was Chris Jones. And he told me lots of stories about Oscar. And I really love the Oscar Robertson stories because Chris Jones, the guy that was my high school coach, he probably averaged more than 20 a game himself. And I don't know what Oscar must have averaged, probably 30 or better. But I know that Oscar was a tremendous scorer. And my high school coach was just a tremendous darn basketball player as well. So I'd have to take Oscar Robertson because Chris Jones would want me to. If he hears this, he would be going, Ron, you should have said Oscar Robertson. But Oscar Robertson was a great, great basketball player. All those guys are great basketball players.
Wow. All right. Okay. Well, I will do my homework assignments, and hopefully – you will, if you do go subscribe to YouTube, you can look up the Sex Pistols, Anarchy in the UK. It's a good video.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'll do that. No, I love music, so I need to catch up on some of that older stuff.
Okay, that's great. And I do hope you produce your own line of barbecue sauce someday, and I'll help you with the ingredients.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you'll need to. You'll need to.
Okay, back to you, Sign Guy.
All right, can you guys hear me?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
All right. Well, we are getting down to the last few minutes of the show, and I want to make sure Mr. Fuller has enough time to plug and promote anything he would like and say anything he would like to the fans. So, Mr. Fuller, the floor is all yours.
Okay. Well, I don't have a whole lot of information, but I do have something I really want to plug. First of all, I'd just like to say, you mentioned earlier, I have a website. It's Tennessee Stud. It's TN, the initials for the abbreviation for the state of Tennessee, TNSTUD.com. And there I have everything. You can find my stud cast on there. You can find my gallery. You can find my stud store. You can find information about me, a lot of different interesting things for fans to go there and take a look at that. I do some social media. I'm at Ron Fuller Welch on Instagram and on Twitter. I have two sites on Facebook because I have tremendous following there. One of them is Ron Fuller Welch. That one is just about totally filled. And there's another one, Ron Fuller Tennessee Stud. That's with the name, the word Tennessee spelled out, Ron Fuller Tennessee Stud on Facebook. And be glad to pick up some friends there. I really liked working with the social media people. My studcast, if you just want the studcast, it's Ron Fuller's Studcast. A pretty simple little deal. You can get it either on my website at tnstud.com. or you can get it at any podcast outlet anywhere. It's all over everywhere. I am a member of Arcadian Vanguard. It's a big podcast company out of New York, and they like my program, and they just take me on. I'm the only independent podcaster they have. They do all their own people. They do Jim Cornette. They do the 605. They do a lot of different big podcasts, but I'm the only independent they've ever had, and so I just get distributed. They help me get out to all these places where fans can pick up my stuff. And the last thing I want to talk about is I have, for the first time ever, and I've been doing these podcasts for 6 months, I'm going to do a super stud cast, a 2-hour super stud cast. I've been talking about this on the stud cast, but this will give me an opportunity to tell fans about it up there in the Northwest. And then this is going to be this coming Sunday. Oddly enough, 2 days from now, on January 14th, it's going to be available. And you can find it. It's a 2-hour stud cast, super stud cast, I call it. You can find it on my website at tnstud.com, and you will click on super stud cast rather than the regular stud cast to get that. Or you can go to patreon.com/studcast. That's a donation site, patreon.com/studcast. It's $2.99 for this 2-hour program, but I'm going to add another hour to it. If you purchase the program or donate, I'm going to give you the Super Stud Cast on Sunday, and 2 weeks later, I'm going to give you the rest of the story. And the person I'm doing it on is a 16-year friend of mine, one of the greatest friends I ever had in wrestling, one of the guys I love more than anybody just about that I've ever known is Andre the Giant. I'm doing this one on Andre. It's my tribute to Andre, and I'm going to tell all the stories about 16 years of traveling on the road and drinking in the bars and just going to the beach and doing whatever it is with a great friend of mine that spent nights in my home, visited me, hung out with me a lot. I think people, if they like the stories that I tell, and a lot of people say I'm a pretty decent storyteller, if they like the stories that I tell, they're going to love this show. This is a must-listen for them. They're going to hear Andre portrayed in a different light than they just ever saw Andre before. And I'm very proud of the show. It's already recorded, obviously. And I believe that $2.99 is a tremendous bargain. You get 3 hours of podcasting. You get the 2-hour Andre Super Stud Cast, and then you get the 1-hour Andre rest of the story, which is all questions and answers from the fans. So that program appears on Sunday, on Monday, on Sunday and Monday on Facebook. My friends can go there, leave questions about Andre that weren't answered in the deal. And then 2 weeks later, there's going to be a 1-hour just questions and answers from the fans, so that it really will be the rest of the Andre story. So that's kind of about it of what I'd like to plug. I'm hoping people will listen to that just to see if they like what I do. If they've listened to Studcast, I think the numbers show that there's a lot of people that love my Studcast. And this one, to me, these Super Studcasts are going to be some of the best that I can do, because I'm going to have 2 hours of straight stories. It's just it's back to back to back to back, and a lot of them are funny. A lot of them are serious and solemn stories. But I think it'll be something people enjoy.
Well, Mr. Fuller, I definitely look forward to the Super Studcast. We had some Andre the Giant stories the last time you were on our program, so I'm sure they're going to be just as good, and I'm sure even better than what we heard on this show last year. And thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate having you on anytime you are available to talk with us. And just for the record, to help QT out, it was Hiro Matsuda that broke the leg of Hulk Hogan.
Hey, boy. Well, goodness, we got an answer already. So that's good. And I can darn sure believe that, because he darn near broke my leg several times too. So I can understand that that could have happened.
All right. Well, Mr. Fuller, thank you again for being with us. Fans, we'll be back with you Sunday afternoon. We have one of our young up-and-coming local wrestlers out of the Pacific Northwest, the hybrid Clark Connors. I think you're going to enjoy him. And if you're looking for some wrestling today, you definitely want to check things out. Make sure shows are still happening. There's lots of inclement weather in the Midwest and the South part of the country, so double check to make sure the shows are happening. We can confirm that WCWO in Indianapolis is happening tonight. Up in our neck of the woods in Seattle, the 3-2-1 battle show is happening. Tomorrow night you have All-Star Wrestling in Vancouver, B.C., SCW, where you can find myself in Bremerton, Washington, and the New Wave Pro Show in Terre Haute, Indiana, also officially still happening. But definitely if you're planning on wrestling, double check, make sure it's still happening with the inclement weather. If you're in a place getting hit by those winter storms, be safe out there, and we will talk to you on Sunday.